Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV, a podcast about television. I am David Chen, and I'm going to sit here sitting completely still for a really long period of time until moving suddenly to surprise you. Joining me today is Patrick Lepik,
whose extremely tired wife prepping for a trip is currently upstairs while I record this, actually putting Five Nights at Freddy characters onto pumpkins so they can go out so the kids can see them in the morning.
Wow. Well, we all have our own cross to bear. Anyway, welcome to a bonus episode of Decoding TV. We are also broadcasting this live right now. I was going to announce this earlier, but I'll just say wasn't sure if this broadcast is going to happen tonight. But now now that we're here, I'm happy to be talking with Patrick Lepik to talk about the new movie Five Nights at Freddy's, based off of the classic video game. Now, you can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. Find us across all platforms, YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, etc. at Decoding TV. I want to say we are going to start by just giving our overall thoughts on this movie, Five Nights at Freddy's, and then dive right into spoilers pretty quickly after that. So if you're afraid of spoilers, then you know don't stick around for very long. The reason I wanted to have this conversation in bonus episode form, Patrick Lepik, is because you're into video games, and also technically this movie is streaming on Peacock, so you know why not?
These are the hoops that David has jumped through to make to make Decoding TV doing this movie work. I'm with you, David. I see a logical A to B line on this one, and we're good to go.
Thanks, Patrick. Your support is always appreciated. I do want to say that people were expecting this movie would come in, domestic box office wise, between $50 and $60 million, like, you know, which would already be an incredible opening for a movie that had a $20 million budget. Instead, it came in around $78 million. It's one of the biggest movie openings of the year, and the numbers are just really incredible on this film. You know, this is the biggest Blumhouse movie opening ever. 36% of the opening night audience was between 13 and 17 years old. Truly, the kids are all right, Patrick. And also, I believe the children are our future. It has an A- cinema score, which is really strong, especially for a horror film. And I think it's the second biggest opening of the year. Second biggest video game adaptation opening ever. You'll never guess what the first one was. It happened earlier this year, Super Mario Bros. So this is an astonishing achievement of, you know, just movie-making video game adaptation. The question before us, Patrick Lepik, is the movie any good? So let's start by going to you, Patrick Lepik, and talking about what is your connection with Five Nights at Freddy's? Like, you've played this game. I never have. I've seen videos of gameplay. But what has been your relationship to the Five Nights at Freddy's game, and why do you think it occupies such a hallowed spot in the popular imagination?
Right. So you mentioned that Five Nights at Freddy's is based on a 2014 video game by a developer by the name of Scott Cawthon, who is a Christian game developer making, for a long time, Christian-based video games that didn't do very well. And my recollection is that one of them had some crude art that sort of resembled an animatronic, and that someone remarked upon it, and that became like the inkling of the idea that eventually became Five Nights at Freddy's. And this is a point-and-click adventure game, basically, in which you are a security guard at night, clicking through these cameras, watching. It's very much reminiscent of like a kind of like an evolved 90s flash game. Like, the art is extremely crude, the design is extremely crude, but it's like charming in its own way, and it's well made. It's a jump scare factory. You are just going from screen to screen, watching objects. You don't even watch them move in these early games. They just literally, it's like a slideshow going from one screen to the other. And then when you click over, it feels fairly randomized on like, has anything changed? But you're like scrutinizing the screen, or a shadow's there, or one of the animatronics has moved there. And you're basically trying to manage the power that you have to survive the night. And if you can go from midnight to 6 a.m., you go to the next night. And the difficulty amps up. The antics of the animatronics amp up. You use more power if you're like shutting a door. And that's like, that is definitely going to stop them from getting in, but you're also sucking out your power. And the moment power's up, whoosh. Those
a lot of resource management. You know what the game reminded me of when I looked at the gameplay was, ironically, Paranormal Activity, the 100%. Movie, which you're just like, most of Paranormal Activity, you're just watching security footage and then waiting for something to jump and surprise you. By the way, Paranormal Activity, Jason Blum's first big success. And he is now the head of Blumhouse, and, you know, Blumhouse had a huge success in horror films, and this is their latest, you know, in a long string of huge successes. So feels like it's coming full circle, Patrick Klepek.
But yeah, no, I think it's absolutely right. And I don't know if there's a direct influence there necessarily on the game, but it comes out of that same kind of era and like the string of like seven Paranormal Activity sequels that they made in the wake of that original one, of which I saw every single one. Not my proudest moment, but once I start a thing, I have to finish it.
As you will watch all seven sequels they will make of Friday Night at Freddy's, or Five Nights at Freddy's.
Well, that is definitely
after the massive success of this film. So,
and so the game takes off primarily because it falls into a very comfortable loop on YouTube and Twitch. But YouTube is more specific than Twitch in this capacity because it's a fun game to play because the consequence is the jump scare, and so that's the game over screen. And also, it's jump scares can be fun. Like it's not necessarily even done effectively, but you know what the consequence is. You know if you screw up in the game, you get the jump scare. And so then it's fun when you get the jump scare because you get the game over screen. And what's more fun than doing it yourself is watching other people do it. And so Five Nights at Freddy's just becomes enormously popular on YouTube. And what's enormously popular on YouTube? Like creators being watched by young kids. And so you... Five Nights, amongst a lot of other horror that I often categorize as sort of like young adult horror, in which it like straddles this line between who is it appealing for, what is the level of violence. Five Nights at Freddy's is really the catalyst for an already existing thing, but really popularizes the concept and then gets mixed up in this creator culture that is really taking off at the same time with folks like Jacksepticeye and Markiplier and other folks who were kind of on the ground floor during that era and rose alongside movies like Five Nights at Freddy's, popularizing responding to horror games, which itself fueled much of like PewDiePie and these other YouTube creators that became like some of the biggest on the platform.
Well, beautiful anthropological description of Five Nights at Freddy's. No joke. Appreciate it. But what was your feelings on the game? Were you like, oh, I'm so into this. I'm Patrick Klepek and I'm so into this. Or
I think it's an interesting premise. Like I enjoy a good jump scare factory. Like I like being on a roller coaster. I don't need everything to be the height of art. I don't need everything to be like an It Follows or a Hereditary. Like sometimes I just want to sit down and have someone go, yeah, and like that can be done better and worse, right?
Beautifully
like,
said.
There's an art to the jump scare, and some are cheaper than others, some are more earned than others. But Five Nights at Freddy's, I really, the fundamental concept of the game over is the jump scare makes the game over just so tense, because as you're watching it go down, your anxiety goes up, you start making more mistakes, and you know that the jump scare is coming, and so there's like an inherent humor and anxiety in it that I found very fun. I didn't connect with the world, the lore. I didn't play past the first game. I thought the first game was very charming, well done. But beyond that, I sort of needed something else to latch onto. And so the connective tissue that lots of players latched onto that was just kind of barely seeded in the first game, that didn't work for me. And so I kind of left that game behind after the first one, while that quietly, you know, turned into a juggernaut.
Got it.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue.
Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
All right, so that's the game. It's obviously become like a huge cultural phenomenon. In comes this movie, which was released simultaneously in theaters and on Peacock. The plot of this film, directed by Emma Tammy, quote, a troubled security guard begins working at Freddy Fazbear's Pizzeria. While spending his first night on the job, he realizes the late shift at Freddy's won't be so easy to make it through, end quote. This movie stars Josh Hutcherson, I would say, is probably the biggest star, but there's also people like Mary Stuart Masterson is in the movie, Matthew Lillard. It has a solid cast. Let's talk about overall thoughts, Patrick Klepek, before we dive into some of the spoilers. What do you think overall of this film?
I think it's pretty bad. The thing is, I cannot separate the viewing experience of watching this movie from the way that I did, which is that I watched it alongside my 7-year-old. She has talked about watching this movie for as long as the trailer has been out, so a year ish, maybe a little less. Did she kind of
latch onto like the YouTube culture of the game, or did she like playing the game, or both?
No, these characters and characters that are adjacent and inspired by them are everywhere. There has been a Five Nights at Freddy's, I'm not as steeped in the media history to say this with like complete confidence, but has led to a sharp rise in, or at least happened concurrently with a sharp rise in kids liking, for like lack of a better term, like twisted kid care, like essentially like things that look cuddly but are a little fucked up. And Five Nights at Freddy's, Poppy's Playhouse, like just you can Google like things that are just like this, like. These are all over YouTube and Roblox, and Roblox specifically. Like Roblox is full, like recommended to kids, like all these like tortured, evil animatronic and other characters. Some that are ripped off from Five Nights at Freddy's because copyright infringement is rampant on places like Roblox, and others that are inspired by Five Nights at Freddy's, but play in the same wheelhouse. I mean, you walk into a Spirit Halloween or a Target, you will see aisles full of these like kid adjacent. Kind of messed up looking characters. And so my daughter falls for these characters devoid of the context of the game and then asks me about them. And then I start filling in that context for her. And then this trailer comes out and she's like, well, we got to watch the movie. And in our house, my children's relationship with media, they aren't allowed to watch is broadly. I don't believe that media and science backs this up, like does not cause actual harm. And so I use my children as a guide over like, what do you think you can handle? I will open the door. We can walk in. If you don't want to do this, we shut the door and we walk out. And then that's how I manage my children's relationship with media. And so if you think you want to watch, obviously there's like rules, like I am not,
and that's
I'm not
gonna, how so, Patrick and his kids ended up watching Two Girls, One Cup.
Yeah, that, it was Martyrs and then that, it was just like right back to back. Not the remake. We go to the original source.
It was 120 Days of Sodom followed by Two Girls, One Cup, and then Five Nights at Freddy's was the media diet.
And so she, like every other day, like for the better part of a year, would like ask about this movie. Can I look at pictures of it? Can we watch the trailer again? And was trying to decide whether she wanted to watch it. And so, long story short, the first night we tried to watch it, we made it 5 minutes into that initial kill. It was too much. She's like, I don't want to do this. Like, I was a little disappointed because I was like, well, I want to see if this movie turned out any good. But okay, I'm going to respect that you don't want to watch it, and we'll give it another shot this weekend if you're up to it. And then on Sunday morning, I was like, hey, it's daytime out. We've got some time to kill before stuff we're doing today. Do you want to try and watch it in the daytime? She's like, yeah. And just like start to finish, glued, like on the screen, explaining the character relationships to me. And so you know, and we'll unpack it. I think this movie is pretty poorly made. I think a lot of it has more to do with this script is just atrocious. It's co-written by the game's creator. The convoluted lore of Five Nights at Freddy exists. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's like well written. And I think that directly translates to a very messy, bloated, slow script for a movie that should not be nearly 2 hours long. It is like ungodly long for what
it has about like 45 minutes of plot worth of plot.
Well, yeah. And I have a deep respect for it because it is trying to make kids horror. Like, it makes choices in how it depicts violence, knowing who its audience is, and trying to, I think, hold their hand through a genre that I think for a lot of people, maybe they're into the games, maybe they found those characters, and then this is the first time they're going into a movie that is going to like depict that for them. And I think the movie is pretty like conscious of that fact, tries to respect the audience that it's for. And I think on that level, there's an immense amount of craftsmanship that's happening in this movie that is unfortunately, I think, weighed down by just an atrocious script that I think with all the other components involved, I think could have been just such a better movie with the component pieces, but the script fails on a fundamental level. But you know who doesn't pay attention to like bad script writing or like it doesn't process? Like a 7-year-old that just wants to see these characters brought to life on screen. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is a huge component of, and also the ability to go, I know what that is. For a lot of children, this is similar to like the MCU, in which like characters I've seen in video games, in animated shows, in comics, seeing that brought to life on screen is magical.
It has its own inherent value, basically.
It has that has power. And for an industry that is struggling in so many ways from COVID, from other media options that young people have, to these ongoing strikes, like, I'm just excited that kids wanted to go to the fucking theater and were psyched to do it. Figure the rest out later. And if Five Absolutely. Nights got them in the door, that makes me happy.
Absolutely. On that last point, if if this gets more teens to watch movies, like if this gets the next generation of people to watch movies, I am thrilled with that, because getting the, you know, Gen Z to be interested in movies has at times proven to be very difficult because they have a lot of other options than we did when we were kids, Patrick Klepek. And, you know, I remember when we were kids, there were only 3 channels on the TV and only 1 movie playing at the local theater. No, I'm just joking. Mm-hmm. But you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Kids have a lot of options when it comes to the entertainment these days. And I still believe in the power of movie going and movies. And, you know, the fact that it's doing so well is really, really heartening. All that being said, let's talk about all the ways in which this movie's terrible. And I do want to just point this out. Like, if you are of the ilk of what I just described, like, if you love this movie or you had a great time, just don't watch or listen to what we're about to talk about. I don't think it's going to be beneficial for you, you know? But if you want to hear a somewhat detailed deconstruction of Five Nights at Freddy's, listen on, won't you? I agree with everything you said. I think that the big problem with this film is the pacing. It just is so little happens during the movie. To its credit, the animatronics are awesome. Like, yeah. I loved the way the, you know, Freddy's animatronics looked. They looked very convincing. There was no point at which I was like, oh, well, that's a guy in there, you know, unless you're supposed to feel that way. Like, it's like, oh, that's, you know, it looked like, oh, these look like things that have been reanimated or whatever the case is. And the biggest disappointment with the film is how little of them we see. Like, they're in the movie. I'm going to just throw this out there. In the 2-hour-long movie, we see them for 10 to 15 minutes. I'm just guessing, right? Maybe a little more, but, like, a shockingly small amount of time. The video game is about you playing the security guard that goes in and, like, tries to figure out what's going on and survive. And the people who wrote this movie thought to themselves, what if we really got into the security guard's psyche? Like, what if we really understood what makes that guy tick? Which, turns out is not that interesting, or at least in the way it's in the film is not that interesting. Patrick Klepek, have you ever seen the film MacGruber?
I've not. It's one of my great, it weighs on me, because I know anyone that has seen that movie, it's like one of their all-time favorite, like, spoof comedies. And like, for some reason, I just haven't found the time to do it. I feel terrible about it.
You should feel awful about that. Yes.
I do. Thank you for confirming it.
It is one of my favorite, like, comedy movies. But I bring up MacGruber because there are some things in life, Patrick Klepek, that are horrible. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But if a movie depicts them in a certain way, it can be comical. So, for instance, in MacGruber, you find out pretty early on in the film that MacGruber's wife got blowed up at his wedding by Val Kilmer. Like, Val Kilmer's character, Dieter von Kumpf, I believe is his name, he explodes MacGruber's wife, right? And it's like a very, like, comical scene because it's so ridiculous the way it's done. Now, in reality, if somebody's wife got exploded at a wedding, that would be horrifying. It would be awful. No, I'm not advocating for that. But in the movie, it's so, like, exaggerated and kind of the way the execution is so, like, arch that it's very funny. So I make that distinction to say that, like, there's a distinction between the seriousness of the thing in real life and how wacky it can be when it's depicted sometimes, right? And I say that because, in my opinion, virtually everything that had to do with the main character, Josh Hutcherson's backstory, was like, felt like it was comically funny and exaggerated. Starting with the opening scene, or the opening sequence in which, let's get into spoilers. We thought the movie wasn't that great. We're going to talk about spoilers now. Security guard Mike Schmidt is at a mall, and he thinks he's witnessing a child trafficking event occurring. And so he grabs the parent and just starts freaking wailing on him. Like, literally, did you see the scene in Fight Club where Edward Norton destroys Jared Leto's face?
Yeah.
Like, it's like, not quite like that, but it's like, oh, it's like that level. He's just freaking wailing on this guy. And I'm thinking, okay, well, that guy's going to press charges. His face is all messed up. That guy's going to press charges. It's going to ruin Mike Schmidt's life. Turns out he just gets a slap on the wrist and gets recruited to work at Freddy Fazbear's Pizza. That's his punishment. Is he's like, oh, well, you know, you got to work at this terrible night security job. It's like, okay, well, I think Mike Schmidt got off pretty easy. But I thought that was like a ridiculous sequence because of it was so over the top. And that's something about this movie, by the way. I think it's really trying for like a heightened over-the-top reality between all that stuff, the Mary Stuart Masterson trying to adopt his daughter plot, like all that just felt very, it didn't feel grounded in any kind of reality. Patrick Klepek, what do you think of the tone of the movie?
No, I'm with you. And I think it speaks to, again, this is the blessing and often the curse of having original creator, like, is this really an adaptation or is it a translation by the original creator exerting an enormous amount of control? Because the arc of the Five Nights at Freddy's games is like, David, I implore you after this, maybe not after this, like give yourself a little bit of space.
Yeah.
Like go read a Wikipedia entry about this, like the lore, like you will, whatever you think, wherever you think it goes, whatever, how convoluted you think it might be, it's like exponentially more than that. And you see that filtered down from these later games into this film where it's an attempt to like retcon in, backfill, drama, exposition, explanations, like connecting the dots. And
right.
I think a lot of that is happening in this film. And it's almost like you can feel the filmmakers wrestling, like, I don't know what the relationship was with the creatives on this film, but it almost feels like they're just rubbing their temples and going, okay, 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 okay. So he gave us this shit sandwich. So what are we going to do? Like, we're going to have to eat it, but like, maybe we can process it into something else.
Let's like, let's kind of like mush it up into like a milkshake potentially.
Yeah, I know Scott told us to do that. I know Scott, he owns the IP. But like, what can we do about this? Like, so, Scott's on set. Like,
so what you're talking about is like, I think in the initial game, for instance, there's no explanation for like why these animatronics are attacking you, right? Like, it does not convey like what they represent.
It's highly limited. It was not intended, like,
but then like
story bible.
As the games go on, it becomes more clear like what's going on. Perhaps there's like ghosts inhabiting where the ghosts come from, and like all that stuff is then explained in the video games over time. But this is a movie that kind of tries to like compress all of that lore, or not all of, but like a significant portion of it.
A lot that's like spread over several games. Like, you know, we're in spoiler territory, so like the Matthew Lillard character being the father, he's this character called Springtrap. And I don't think they actually utter that name because I don't think he's becoming Springtrap at the end of the game when he's kind of getting trapped in the suit. But like, that was a huge, like, if you go and like look on like YouTube and people like recorded reactions of like folks, like you hear the kids go nuts. They're like, Springtrap's not supposed to be, this is the first one. And so, you know, it's one of those things where it's almost as though like the target audience for this movie is so specific that if you are outside of what it is aiming at, it comes across as complete nonsense because the movie's not giving you like its own language to work with. Like, if you don't if you don't speak it, then you're not going to connect on its level. And because this, like, the bones of it are so poor, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, all right, well, I'm already a fan and I don't speak the language and I can't point my finger at like, oh, I know that. Well, then you can't fall back on, well, but like the it's really tense and like the characters are interesting. The drama's good. Like, there's nothing else there at all. It all falls apart if like the references don't, and the literal act of adapting to live action doesn't work for you. Cause I'm with you. None of that stuff, like, it's melodrama in this, like, the most laughable way. There's just like nothing to it.
You know, on that note, right, we find out that Mike Schmidt, he dreams of the fact that his brother Garrett was kidnapped and then presumably murdered many years ago. He's haunted by this dream, which, again, I also found to be, like, child trafficking is no joke. Like, I think it's a very upsetting concept, but the way in which it's depicted in the film, I found to be very goofy. And I'll just throw out as an example. It happens when they're out camping in the middle of the woods. And typically, like, look at another example, Minority Report, right? Like, a very similar scene happens in Steven Spielberg's Minority Report. And if you look at that scene, literally, it is one of the most densely populated scenes ever. Like, it's like, there's like hundreds of people in this shot where, like, and that's typically how it happens. It's like, you know, there's all these people and then a parent loses track of their child. It doesn't happen when you're out in the middle of nowhere as much. I'm not saying it never happens, but it's like, it doesn't happen when you're out in the middle of nowhere as much. And it really feels like they just didn't have the budget to shoot this in a big crowded place. Like, it feels like they're just like, okay, we need to shoot the scene where he gets abducted, but like, we don't have budget for more than like 10 people in this movie. So like, where's a place where it would be logical that there would still be danger, but there's very few people. And it's like, oh, out in the middle of the forest. I guess, but it just comes off looking very goofy. It just felt very silly to me. Like, I couldn't take it seriously. Am I like misreading Patrick Klepek? What was your reaction to the Garrett kidnapping?
All those scenes have like a Lifetime quality
right,
to it.
Yeah.
You know, like one of the sort of like cheesy, low budget, like on in the background cable, like adaptations of like a horrible thing that happened to somebody that they can just sort of churn through. I'm with you. Like, it was just incredibly hard to take, like, an obviously traumatic moment.
Right. Like, it's supposed to be like deeply. It's supposed to be like deeply upsetting.
Right, and it is, but, like, when you say it out loud, it's like, oh, well, that's awful. But like in the
context when you're watching, it's just like, this is so. It just the vibes are off in terms of like how this scene is supposed to be communicated to the audience, basically.
Right, and it's too bad because like the actual. Kind of a kernel of something there of like someone taking sleeping pills because they're so traumatized by this singular event. And they think to themselves, well, at some point when I moved my head from left to right here, I saw something. I just didn't process it. I just didn't sort of like actually categorized as a memory. And if I just go back there, maybe I'll unlock it. Like that is a like neat idea. It's also like very convenient because it allows them to sidestep the actual mechanics of the video game, of which they are just not present, which is like they have the office, but then the whole point of the game is you are sitting in the office going through these cameras. And then now I get they wouldn't be managing a power. That's just a crude gameplay system in order. Right. Like essentially the movie is like, all right, well, it'd be kind of boring, I guess, if he's just sitting there in front of the security system for 6 hours. So he should sleep through it and then just wake up later. And we'll skip that whole part that is the basis of the game, which I think speaks to like a less of an interest in translating, which I think you were getting at earlier, actually makes sense as a pretty, especially Paranormal Activity, where it has a concept of like day, like night one, day one, like night two, day two. And like you have a familiar cycle you could go through where you can imagine a film adapting that, like sitting behind the desk, the cameras, like you could do like a under 90 minute film that was like pretty effective that way. But this movie's way more concerned with
it's more ambitious than that. It like wants to do more. It wants to be like, you know, tell the whole story of Mike Schmidt, the entire life story of Mike Schmidt, and how, like, you know, going through this seminal event of being the security guard of Five Nights at Freddy's helped him to exorcise his demons, right? That's kind of the story tells. And so I can't fault it for being more ambitious, because you're right. Like, that sounds like potentially a cool movie. Like, very cool low-budget movie where it's just a guy looking at security screens, you know, and figuring out a way to, like, shoehorn that mechanic into a film could be interesting. But they decided not to go that way, and instead... they decided to, you know, go this way of like Mike Schmidt is being tormented by these machines, and also he wants to keep his daughter. The other thing about the thing too is like, at no point did I root for Mike Schmidt. I don't know if you like, if you felt this way, but
he's a huge fuck up. Like, he's constantly making horrible decisions.
He is introduced brutally assaulting an innocent man. And then you find out, like, he's really traumatized by, like, his brother being abducted, which, like, fair, anyone would be.
Yeah.
But he doesn't seem to be doing a good job raising his daughter. His aunt wants to take control.
Sister. It's his younger sister.
Oh, sorry, his sister. His aunt wants to take custody of both of the sister. And he's like, you know what? She should, because I'm not equipped to raise a child. And I'm like, yes, that is correct. Yes, you're right, Mike Schmidt. Like, yes, just let her go. Now, to be fair, she doesn't want to be taken custody of. So, like, she has some agency in this. But the whole time I was like, dude, Mike Schmidt, why are you fighting for this, man? Like, this is and by the way, he actively endangers her, you know, multiple times in the course of the movie. What was your relationship with Mike Schmidt? Were you like, I really support this guy?
No. I mean, like, again, like, it's like, well, this... You got me. Like, his brother was kidnapped and probably brutally murdered. So I guess I still feel bad for him. And that would probably cause me to make some poor decisions in my life. But the movie really wants you to like sympathize with him on a moment to moment basis. And not just as a like broadly, like, wouldn't you feel sad for a person that went through this? And it's just the movie does like over and over has his character making boneheaded decisions that do not seem in line with somebody that wants to like wrestle control of their life. And some of it is honestly down to performance. I honestly think the acting choices for Mike, whether instructed or chosen by the actor, like give a real like sleepy, lazy, like quality to the character that makes them hard to root for as a protagonist, where it's like, if something was like coming through beyond these poor choices, and I don't know if that's down to directing. I don't know if that's like, there's just no good words on the page for us to get, like, I don't know where that breakdown happens, but I often found myself just like hard to get situated in his shoes. And your other options as a viewer are difficult because the character, like the sister, she doesn't talk that much. She doesn't really open up as a character until much later. The cop is just a completely odd, like, really makes no sense until we get some reveals towards the end. Right. Like, Like,
well, to be clear, nothing in the movie makes any sense until you get to the end, right? Like, it's like, why would you hire someone to watch an abandoned Chuck E. Cheese? It doesn't make any sense. Of course, we find out in the end there's reasons for that. Why is this cop spending what seems to be her entire shift? Like, just hanging out with this guy at the abandoned Chuck E. Cheese, right?
If you want to kiss him, just kiss him. But, like, it seems really weird coming up with a lot of excuses to come over and hang out with. Like, that whole bit where those folks come in and ransack the pizzeria, and then she goes to show up and be like, hey, I'm going to have to file a report, and that's criminal negligence. And he's like, hey, you want to go hear a sob story by the river? And, like, he explains this whole deal, and she's like, I shouldn't report that. You're right. You know, like, no, like, what? I mean, obviously it makes sense by the end of the movie because she has, like, her motives are nefarious, or at least in cahoots, in a way that
but, she has ulterior motives, right?
Right, but none of it makes – and she's not being communicated as, an untrustworthy character in the moment. She is meant to be somebody showing sympathy for a person that clearly needs, like, a helping hand. So it just makes it feel just utterly nonsensical because, like, these characters aren't acting with any motivations that, like, it's a plot hole that's not a plot hole until I know what fills the hole with the plot. But it feels so odd in the moment. Like, there's just nothing to grab onto except just, I really hope we get back those animatronics, like, literally as soon as possible because that's, I want to see them blink again. Give me the cupcake. Give me the cupcake. The cupcake's good.
There's also this subplot where Jane, the aunt character, hires a group of vandals to trash the restaurant to get Mike fired, right? And I'll just say that I don't know that she chose wisely in terms of the group of vandals that she was hiring. This is the most eclectic group. Because I think, like the babysitter's in there, right? Like,
yeah.
There's, like, you know...
the babysitter's boyfriend. I don't know who the other guy is.
Guy who looks like he comes from like a grunge band in his 40s and 50s, and then like a teenager who looks like he works at the local pizzeria, and it's like, you know, and then you just throw all of them in there and then trash the place and hope that goes well. Of course it doesn't. Anyway, so eventually what happens in the movie is you find out that the animatronics, they want to absorb Abby into their collective, right? That is to say, Mike's sister. They want to absorb Abby. And then turns out, not only is Matthew Lillard's character, the guy that hires Mike, the father of the cop character, right? But he's also the person that has entrapped these children's spirits in these animatronic dolls. Am I right about that? Like, what's...
You are. There's, they don't get into the real mechanics of it, but yeah.
He's a serial killer that has murdered Garrett and five children by hiding their bodies in the animatronics, and their souls are under his control. That is the big reveal at the end of the film, right?
Yeah, we don't get the explanation for the control. We just know that he has it, but we know that to avoid getting caught, he hid their mangled bodies in the animatronics. So the cop, like, I guess he put enough, like, chemical spray in there so like the smell didn't radiate off of, but like whatever, like I don't care about the logic there, but he hid the bodies in there, and then at some point there's a bit of a, at least in this film, a yada yada yada, and then children's souls are infused in the animatronics.
Yeah, and I gotta say, like, the conclusion of the movie plays out in a very anticlimactic fashion. I thought, I don't know about you, but I was not thrilled by it. Like, the idea is that they're supposed to have this big confrontation, and Matthew Lillard's character, a.k.a. I think Steve is the name of the character, Steve Raglan, a.k.a. William Afton, you're supposed to be like, oh, they finally turned the tables on this guy. And, you know, there's literally nothing happened. Like, basically his machine, they trigger his animatronic that he put on. So that it starts, like, impaling him. That's kind of what happens, right, at the end. But that's it. There's no action scene. There's no, like, oh, they did something really clever. I mean, they did something. Like, Abby shows her drawing to the animatronics, and they turn on William. That's kind of what causes them to turn on him. But, like, there was so little that happened until that point, and then the big climax was so anticlimactic. It felt like just very deflating. What did you think of the final sequence, Patrick Klepek?
Well, I at least knew that I'm so glad they cast Matthew Lillard. He is wonderful in the very brief amount of screen time that he's like great as the kind of slimy, like work recruiter character. His full mask off, like villain moment, like strong, like scream energy, like happening here. Like he's a lot of fun. Like he knows he's going to amp the energy up, like in this scene. And he's a lot of fun for the little, a bit of time that we get with him. But I'm with you. I mean, like it's difficult because one, I think you start to see the limitations of what the animatronics are capable of, in terms of what can they depict. We see that earlier in the film when the longest sequence that you get with the animatronics outside of the climax, where they build a fort with Abby, and like watching them like try to shoot around them, lifting up you can just see like they're like, okay, we can get them to move, and like the faces work really well, but the actual like getting them down a hallway doing like limb actions, there's just not a ton that those animatronics can pull off. And when you get to the finale, I think that collides with a distinct lack of character development for any of these kids we're supposed to feel sad about, right? Like we get precious few moments of like, we have this whole framing device of going into this dream, but we don't like hear any of the stories about these kids. Like, what has it been like for, you know what I mean? Like, there's nothing to emotionally sort of hang on to other than the broad explanation that he murdered these kids, sad, put their mangled bodies into animatronics, also sad. Mm-hmm. But we don't have any insight into who they are. And is that because when, you know, you read that Matthew Lillard signed like a 3-picture deal for these films, that like, oh, they're saving development on like any of these characters for future films. That's certainly possible. But I think it leaves the entire climax to hinge on, if you are not a kid like oogling at like the set piece of it all, essentially like how far can Matthew Lillard take you here? Is not far enough? Well, like there's not much else for you here.
I think you're right to praise Matthew Lillard, though. He really is giving it his all, and like his commitment cannot be questioned, right? But I would agree with you. The finale gives you precious little to hang on to, other than the twist of, hey, their bodies are the blah blah blah. You know, like, we have some questions in the chat from somebody named Native Indie, who is asking about. I think is concerned about the PG-13 nature and whether this is a movie that is safe to watch for children. I know your philosophy is, let's just say, radical permissiveness, Patrick Klepek. No, I'm just,
sure.
I'm
being facetious. But like, I say that's right. Yeah. No.
But would you recommend this for children? It's PG-13. I think the gore and terror is fairly light. I will say, you know, one of the opening scenes of the movie is like an animatronic device being shoved in this guy's face that has like all these gears and terrible things that are going to like mangle his face and kill him. And I do think if I had watched that when I was a kid, that would be traumatizing. You know, like that's a very scary idea to have your face all messed up by like a machine, you know? That was probably the scariest thing in the whole movie for me. Like nothing else really came close to that idea, which appears several times during the course of the movie. But I'm curious, like, you know, do you feel like your children will be traumatized by this, or like, this is a movie you feel okay recommending to kids of a certain age?
I don't think it's shocking that I watched this in two phases with my kid, which was the first 10 minutes. This is, I don't want to do this anymore, Dad. Okay, we turn it off. And if you don't want to do this anymore, I'm not here to force you to do it. I'm just here to be like, bumpers for you as you figure out what you can handle. And then I'm not shocked that when she said, can we just not watch the first 10 minutes? And I was sure. And
that does have the sequence I discussed, right? Like
correct.
The guy's face being endangered. Yeah.
And it is absolutely the scariest moment.
Yeah.
And even though we don't actually see gore, it's the closest, it's just the most intense, scarily shot. Yeah. It's a great scene. And the movie never quite reaches those heights, or even tries to. Like, again, it's always pulling its punches deliberately. It's not as though it's cutting. Like, I don't think there's an R-rated cut of Five Nights at Freddy's. Like, I think they shot it the way they shot it on deliberately and on purpose, and the movie is what the movie is. But the thing of like, should a kid watch it? Like, so, at the age I'm talking about, like, so much is kid dependent. Like, a lot of 7 year olds probably shouldn't. Like, there's a lot of criteria. Does your kid easily get nightmares? My kid doesn't. She has never had a nightmare in her life. She finds herself attracted to horror and horror adjacent media already. So she is like seeing things that are violent-y and is comfortable and like is able to process that in a healthy fashion. So I felt okay having her watch that until the moment that she wasn't. And most parents are going to be on a gut check, like, because I'm writing a story about this over at Crossplay. And I was like, bunch of parents are like, yeah, my kids love like the Funko Pops for this thing. And like, they love Five Nights at Freddy's, but then they won't make it 5 seconds into the trailer before we turn it off because the scary music kicks in. And they're like, so I'm not letting my kid watch this because I know exactly how they're going to react. And so I think outside of that range, I think you had mentioned earlier, like the demographic of this was like highly concentrated in like 11 to 13, 11 to 14, like as you're getting into that early teenage range, or like, I think 10 and above, you are in extremely solid ground. Mm-hmm. If your kid doesn't have a propensity to be easily scared or have images like linger with them, yeah, especially upon early exposure.
And definitely, but, like, teenagers, I said 13 to 17 years old was like 36% yeah, of the audience. I think that's very reasonable. Like, that's very, you know,
yeah,
I feel like I could probably handle this if I was a teenager, you know? So
yeah. And again, because a lot of the violence is not explicit. I think the goriest it gets is a couple of like slashes on an arm, but it doesn't linger. Like, a body is split in half, but it's seen in shadow and silhouette. At one point you see some bodies on the ground that are like gory. They were like the people who were killed earlier. But again, it's like brief shots. It doesn't linger. It's not going for that level. It's not a gross out movie. Mm-hmm. And like, the violence exists because they are animatronics that want to kill you. But it doesn't linger in the way that you, it's very easy to imagine an R-rated version of this film. It has all the elements to be much more intense. And you know, you can go watch that Nicolas Cage, like Willy's Wonderland or something like that, if you want something that really turns the screws a little bit more. But it's very much like, I'd say under 10, your mileage may vary. Know your kid. Above that, I think you're going to be on pretty safe ground. It is no more intense than, you know, it's not that more intense than, like, the new the Goosebumps show that's going mm-hmm. around. Like, your kid can handle that. This is just like a little above that. It's just a little more explicit with the violence.
So the end of the film, the serial killer is impaled by his own animatronic, which is like,
ugh,
wow, you did
classic.
Hoisted by his own petard. You know, it's always, they always get you the way you never expect, aka your own killing machine that you have donned yourself for no apparent reason. Anyway, they drag Vanessa off. Like, Abby is saved. They drag Vanessa, the cop, off. And she goes to the hospital, and she's basically in a coma, as far as I can tell. Mm-hmm. And that's where she ends the film. So we don't know whether Vanessa lives or dies. I have a feeling she's going to live until the next one, though. That's just my guess.
Yeah. Oh, they were holding hands, David. Like, come on. Him this love?
I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm putting my whole professional career on the line. And I'm going to say I think Vanessa's going to survive till the next movie.
Wow.
Unless she is recast and they decide they don't need that character anymore, in which case she's going to die off screen. And then Mike and Abby, I guess all their problems are solved at that point. Everything just goes back to normal, right? That's the end of the movie. So, yeah. What have we learned, Patrick Klepek? What are our thoughts here? I mean, I do think that this is clearly a movie that's not for us, you know? This is a movie that's for people who are like, get that joy out of just seeing these characters come to life, as you so eloquently put it earlier on in the podcast. And I think the big lesson for me is that there is a massive market for stuff that is just not on anyone's radar. Like, most of the, like, or not anyone, adults' radar. Like, most adults, if you're like, hey, you're going to go see Five Nights at Freddy's, they'd be like, who are you, sir? This is a Wendy's. But if you asked a friend, they would say, I don't know what you're talking about. And there's clearly properties like this that, like, you know, sometimes they take a crack at it and it's like Assassin's Creed and no one goes to see it. And sometimes they take a crack at it and it's Five Nights at Freddy's and it's a massive, massive success. And you just can't underestimate how much people want to see certain video games be rendered with some relative reverence. Like, I even though the gameplay is not replicated, like, it seems like they didn't dishonor.
Loves the material. I think
the material, right? Exactly.
Like, so, I think a huge part of the problem is that it is too referential to a lot of the indulgent material in the games to function as a more broad appeal movie as opposed to the Five Nights at Freddy audience.
Yeah, yeah. Closing thoughts, Patrick Klepek.
Look, I have such complicated thoughts about this movie because, like, I never really want to watch it again, and yet there's a good chance I'm going to watch it 20 more times in like the run up to the sequel. And
on the one hand, it's been a colossal waste of time, and may God have mercy on your soul.
Right.
On the other hand, you can't wait to see it again.
I can't wait, but you know, I've been fortunate to do these podcasts with you and talk about, a lot of TV shows. And in this case, a movie on a television show streaming service. And I was not that excited for my kids to get into video games. I knew it was going to happen because they're just surrounded by it. It is just part of their lives in a way that they just take for granted, in a way that I couldn't, because it was just, I grew up as video games became popular and a part of culture and a part of my life. And I write about video games every day. I think about video games every day. And it's just like, sometimes with my kids, I just wanted to not think about video games. And so, you know, if video games are my career, like, my actual passion is like the horror genre. It's like the thing that means the most to me. It's like the only physical objects I own other than like horror literature is like, you know, 350 like Blu-rays and 4Ks that I have, like all horror movies. I don't buy any other films. It's just the horror genres. The only ones that I buy discs for. And so I have no intention of forcing my kid to get into something they don't want. But if you're asking me, like, would Patrick be so over the moon if his child like went down that path and like I got to hold their hand while they did it? Like, abso-fucking-lutely. And so I don't know what Five Nights at Freddy does. I think this is going to be a gateway movie to a lot of kids to like, oh, like, this gives me a sense of like how I react to a horror film, like what I like, what I don't like, what's fun about being scared, what's not fun about being scared, how to do that in a safe environment and like manage those feelings. I don't know where my kid goes from here. And maybe it's just Five Nights at Freddy's and it's nothing else. But like, for that brief moment, similar to that when I sat next to her, like holding her hand during like Super Mario Brothers in the theater, like that was like a generational like thing we got to share together in a movie that was just okay, very pretty, but just an okay as a film. Here is a movie like I don't really like as a film all that much, but like as an object that connected the two of us and like an interest that means a lot to me, like I cannot, like, it will be one of my favorite film experiences of the year. Like, the movie itself is really take it or leave it, and mostly leave it. But like the experience of like sitting next to my kid and like watching her go through these emotions and sharing that with me is like, it's fun. It was priceless. And so I'm thankful for the movie on that regard. And mostly what I hope is that the sequels are better. You know what I mean? It's like,
cause you're going to have to watch them.
I'm going to have to watch them. I think the foundation is there for something much better. And maybe with some of the foundation out of the way, I hope they can give, like, with more of a budget, more complicated animatronics. You know what I mean? Like, I think they're, again, the pieces are here for something that could be cool or at least, at the very least, better than what's here. Whether they achieve that in the inevitable sequel, I don't know. But that's where I ended up with the movie. It's like, it's a pretty bad movie. And kids' entertainment doesn't have to be bad. I think that's also like a critical thing. Is like sometimes people are excusing this film for like, well, it's meant for kids. Of course it's bad. It's like, well, kids' stuff doesn't have to be bad. But despite the fact that this was bad, I still found it to be like a profoundly special experience to at least share with my kid.
Well, that's heartwarming, Patrick. And I love how we have described many great impacts of Five Nights at Freddy's, none of which have to do with the artistic content of the film. It's great for theaters. It's great for Blumhouse. You know, it's great for the future of the movie-going industry. It's great for Patrick's family and his movie-going activities.
The movie is the biggest horror opening for a female director, right?
Right. Like, the movie itself, biggest piece of dog shit we've seen in the last 6 months, you know? but everything else about the movie, we strongly support. And please, let that be the takeaway from this episode of Decoding TV. You can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. I meant to make this announcement earlier on, by the way. This week's Loki recap probably going to come out a little bit later than usual. So just be aware of that because of scheduling reasons. And also, possibly somebody's going to be stepping in for Patrick this week because he's going to be away. So just, you know. If it's not because Patrick Klepek got a job at a security guard at Fazbear's, it's because scheduling reasons. So just be aware of that. But yeah, podcast.decodingtv.com. I'm really excited about this week's episode of Loki. I think it's going to be really interesting. So we'll see.
Yeah, same.
Let us know what you thought about Five Nights at Freddy's and everything else we're talking about over at Decoding TV by emailing us at decodingtv@gmail.com. He is Patrick Klepek. I'm David Chen. Patrick, tell people where they can find more of your work on the internet this week.
You can listen to me talk about video games over at Remap. You can get those wherever podcasts are downloaded, and you can see us now writing at our new website at remapradio.com. That's right, remap.com. Now I forget what the actual website
really
is.
Wow, you had one job.
It was remap.ghost.io, and then we bought a domain. It's remapradio.com.
You had one job.
All of my parenting and gaming and technology stuff is at crossplay@patrickklepek.substack.com.
All right, folks. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you later right here on Decoding TV. Goodbye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.